Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
I am a personal and private chef and a caterer, and the cost of food has gone up so much that I have had to charge my clients more, which they are not happy with. And so it has, you know, a domino effect on my business. The higher cost of food leads me to charge higher prices, which gives my clients pause. So hopefully someday they'll go down, but I don't see that in the foreseeable future.
That's Pierre, an On Point listener from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, sharing a familiar tale. The higher than usual inflation rate, currently challenging home economies and national politics. The Consumer Price Index up more than 5% over last year, the highest rate in more than a decade. So as Pierre wonders, how long will it last? Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said on CNN that past is prologue in this case, and she expects inflation to stay high into 2022. But
I don't think we're about to lose control of inflation. I agree, of course, we are going through a period of inflation that's higher than Americans have seen in a long time. And as we make further progress on the pandemic, I expect these bottlenecks to subside. Americans will return to the labor force as conditions improve.
And until then, if inflation is an emergent property of various economic forces, are there places where the government can push back to push prices back down? Well, here's one thing President Biden says he could do.
I could go in the petroleum reserve and take out and probably reduce the price of gas maybe 18 cents or so a gallon. It's still going to be above $3.
Well, pundits are pushing back across media. Everyone from former Clinton Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers to Jesse Waters on Fox News.
He doesn't understand in a recovery, you have to have supply meet demand. So you can't be taking away permits and pipelines and leases. So right now we're begging OPEC to increase supply. And OPEC's saying, screw you. We're going to see this thing go to $100 a barrel and we're going to get rich and Joe can go scratch.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And look, regarding those energy and oil prices, I'm old enough to remember way back when the price of oil was so low, people were wondering if it could go into negative territory. Because that was just last year. So if you're experiencing some kind of whiplash over the big swing from that memory to this year's rising prices, well, join the club. In fact, historian Rebecca Spang says if we are all honest about how confused we are, it would be a very, very big club.
Ordinary Americans and politicians often talk about inflation as something that can be easily measured, can be seen just by looking out the window at the economy. But inflation is one of those words that may conceal more than it reveals.
So today, we're going to talk first about what inflation really is. What does that word, that misunderstood concept, reveal once properly understood? What causes it? Why does it even exist? And once we know those things, we will ask, what can we expect from this period of higher than usual inflation? Well, joining me today from Easton, Maryland, is Laura Tyson. She was chair of the Council of Economic Advisors and director of the National Economic Council in the Clinton administration. She also served on the Council on Jobs and Competitiveness and the Economic Recovery Advisory Board under President Obama. She's now also a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor Tyson, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
Also with us is Jack Beattie, our own On Point news analyst. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Magda. Hello, Professor Tyson.
Hello.
So, Laura Tyson, the first thing I want to ask you is just yesterday, we did a show about the folly of just quoting percentages to people because they actually may not relatively mean much. And yet I did it today, right, in the first paragraph of the show saying that higher than usual inflation rate of plus 5%. So put that in context for us. How unusual is it right now, and are you concerned?
Well, I think I want to start with, again, just the clarification of what inflation is, and then that percentage will make some sense, perhaps. So inflation is a measure of a growth of prices. The prices are goods and services that we buy, and inflation measures the rise in the prices of goods and services over some period of time. So that 4% number that you mentioned, actually the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, which is a standard way to measure it in the United States, in September was 5.4%. That means that over the 12 months into September, the prices of goods and services rose approximately 5%. Now, I want to say approximately because within that bundle of goods and services, some prices are rising faster than 5%, some prices are rising slower than 5%. You mentioned oil, commodity prices. Those are rising faster than 5%.
So by a lot faster, something like more than 40% for energy.
But basically, as you said, you measure it over a period of time, and we're coming off of very low prices. Actually, as you said, there was concern that would these prices go so low that they would discourage any production whatsoever. So, yes, the price increase right now is pretty substantial because you compare over a period of time when they were very low to now much higher. So I just want to indicate the inflation rates are always measured over some period. Some period of time.
Well, so I'm looking at a historic inflation rate chart here for the United States from 1960 to to this year, okay? And to your point, I think a lot of us have just grown used to that between 2 to 4% inflation rate, with the exception of just after the Great Recession when it was at zero for at least a year.
It plummeted, right. It plummeted after the Great Recession.
Yeah, but then go ahead. No, please.
I also want to say, because I think the historian made this point, we did not anticipate, essentially, I would say, 20 years of gradually declining inflation. So that was true throughout the 2000s. And then it was going into 2019 when the economy was really very strong, but the inflation rate was very low. That was, I want to say, somewhat surprising. So I think in all of this discussion, we need to understand that it's hard to make predictions about inflation. There are various factors, and we'll talk about them. But let's start with the fact that the economy is in a kind of weird place right now. It's strong, but weird. I like the term weird. Someone used that recently. So making predictions is complicated. And even when it wasn't weird, the inflation numbers were hard to predict. Okay, just want to start there, make sure everybody understands that this is not precise science.
but yet we treat it as such, right, in the media and in politics, and the consequences of that are pretty significant, which we'll get into later. But let me turn to Jack Beattie here, because, you know, we can talk about the abstraction of the numbers that go into creating this concept of inflation, Jack. But right now it is having a very real impact on people. You want to talk about that a bit, Jack?
Well, sure. Everything from coffee to toilet paper is going up. Tide, Pampers, Starbucks, up. Verizon, they're going to increase their bills. And according to the food writer for the New York Times, we are heading for the most expensive Thanksgiving dinner in history. Turkey, stuffing, sweet potatoes, aluminum roasting pans, coffee, pie, packaged dinner rolls, the canned cranberry sauce, all up. And it's out there and it's headed. People are feeling it already. One poll shows 63% very concerned about the rise in prices. And then, of course, you mentioned the gas prices. In California now, to fill up a tank, a 14-gallon tank, you're spending $20 more than you were a year ago. All of this has James Carville ruminating. It's like an old nightmare girlfriend from 40 years ago who shows up on your front step. She's called inflation.
Oh, dear. Well, you know, okay, so this gets to my next question of about it, that it's not a great situation right now. No one's going to say that. But to the point Jack was making, say again, about gas prices being so much more than they were last year. I mean, a lot of how we talk about this depends on where, what points we want to make the comparisons across, right, Laura Tyson? Because last year we had a profound demand collapse, which is one of the reasons why, say, for energy and oil and gas, we saw that major drop in prices. So, you know, check me here. Is the best comparison to make for the inflation on energy prices between now and a year ago in the worst part of the pandemic?
I think it's misleading, and that goes to my point about the weirdness of the situation we're in. Because if the pandemic year had been more normal, if 2020 had been more normal and the first half of 2021 had been more normal, then there would have been some inflation, but it would have been relatively low. What happened is as the economy began to recover rapidly, look, producers understandably could say, I want to increase my price to make up for the fact that I couldn't increase my price on a regular basis in 2020. I didn't, or 2021. Let me catch up. So there's some catch up going on here that's important. And once the, for those who think, and I'm one of them, but subject to my reflection that we could, I could be wrong, I'm one of the what's called the temporary or transitory analysts. I think that there are particular temporary factors playing into this right now. And what are the temporary factors? Prices are about supply and demand. That's what they're about, okay? And so forget inflation for a minute, just prices are supply and demand. On the demand side, we actually did pump a lot of demand spending power into the U.S. economy in 2020 and 2021 through fiscal stimulus measures. To basically make the economy grow and recover.
And it's Laura Tyson, successful. Yeah, hang on for just a second here, because we just have to take a really quick break, and we'll pick up with that thought when we come back, because I do want to explore in depth the whys of what's happening right now. So Laura Tyson and Jack Beattie, we'll be back in a minute. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today it's Inflation 101. Everything you wanted to know about inflation, but were afraid to ask because we're experiencing a period of higher than usual inflation right now. But I'm also wondering whether part of the problem is that we were experiencing lower than what may be quote-unquote good inflation for quite some time. But we'll get to that in a second. I'm joined today by Laura Tyson. She was an advisor on both the Clinton and Obama administrations and now is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley's Haas School of Business. And Jack Beattie joins us as well. He's On Point news analyst. And Professor Tyson, you were talking about what you said was the success of the COVID-related stimulus that was pumped into the economy over the past year or so. And I want you to pick up on that thought, but let me just share a quick comment that we got from a listener on exactly this issue. Michael Richards feels a little bit differently. Michael said the Federal Reserve, in his words, is, quote, inflating the money supply, you know, talking about the $7 trillion, he says, pumped into the economy since the beginning of the pandemic. And then he says, we are in serious trouble here. Children in school right now will never be able to afford a house. This has started a chain of events that will turn us into a nation of renters. So how much should we look to the stimulus as a cause of current inflation?
Well, first of all, I want to distinguish between monetary stimulus, the central bank, the Federal Reserve, mm-hmm. and fiscal stimulus. Basically, during the economy, during the time of the very slow recovery from the 2007-2008 financial crisis, and then once again, once we got into the pandemic recession, both the monetary authorities and the fiscal authorities strengthened policies to increase demand. Because the way to get out of a recession is to have enough demand for goods and services, growing demand, that producers will begin to produce more products, more services. So that was the right thing to do. I believe it was the right thing to do, and it worked to stimulate demand in the economy and to bring us faster than expected out of the pandemic recession, which was a sudden and deep recession that we've recovered from more quickly than expected. Now let me go to the supply side, though, because prices depend on demand and supply. So what I think was not anticipated by anyone was the severity of the supply disruptions caused by COVID. Mm. Those are disruptions in the supply chain. You saw the pictures of all of those boats out in LA Harbor. It's not just that products are more expensive, but they actually, it's taking them longer to get to the store, and there are shortages. There are literally shortages because products are lined up on ships. That's an example of a supply chain problem. There are many, many, many others. I just use that. There's the issue of labor shortages. A lot of the labor force participation rate, a measure of how much of the labor force available is working. During the recession, a lot of people lost or left low-wage jobs. This is hospitality and leisure. This is the food industry that you mentioned at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Those workers are slowly coming back. But I have to say, those wages are still, they're low wages, and given the rate of inflation, the purchasing power of those wages is not very attractive. So basically, it's taken a slower process to get people back into those jobs. They don't want to go into the jobs. They're not attractive enough. And I think that those are some key things. Commodity prices are particular. I want to say the oil prices we've seen during periods of rapid global recovery, and I think that we are in one of those now, yeah, that's going to drive up commodity prices. It's going to drive up energy prices. Mm. So that's why it's important, I think, to also look at the consumer prices excluding food and energy. That's another measure that's commonly used. They all move together, but the consumer price index without food and energy, what's called the core, is only rising at 4%, not 5.4%. So this, to a certain extent, depends upon what you buy. I would say you're talking about it from the point of view of households. A household looks at what they buy. Okay, they buy some things, not other things. They look at the prices of those things. But they also look at their income. And so one of the key things about inflation is we need to look at what's happening to people's income.
Yes.
Because inflation will erode the purchasing power of that income unless the income is growing as fast as the inflation rate.
Right. So this is a really important point. Ray Russell on Facebook says inflation hurts the less fortunate the worst. For the middle class, it steals their discretionary income and hurts small businesses that depend on it. Mm-hmm. So that's the key mm-hmm. thing, right? It's inflation relative to what, right?
Relative to what?
Exactly.
To who you are, what you buy, where you stand in the income distribution, whether you have, so let's take Social Security recipients. Even though Social Security recipients, Social Security is inadequate, woefully inadequate for many people to provide support for their standard of living relative to their living when they worked. Nonetheless, it is indexed. So essentially, this year, the Social Security payments are going to go up by more than 5% because they're indexed to the rate of inflation. So that's actually a plus for Social Security recipients. But wages, for those people who are working average hourly wages, they're not going up at 5%. Actually, we've had 6 months now of falling average monthly wages because they're not rising as fast as the inflation rate is rising. So the real wage, that's the thing, the real purchasing power of your income, you compare what's happening to, I'm getting a 5% increase in my wage. but my goods are 5.4%. So my real purchasing power is down a little.
Jack Beattie,
your wages.
Yeah, let me just let's turn back to Jack here for a second, because I mean this is the important duality here, right? Like perhaps as Laura Tyson is saying, Jack, a 5%. Inflation rate this year wouldn't bite so much if, you know, we also hadn't had years and years and years of relatively low or in some sectors, zero wage growth.
Well, that's right. And I mean, I think people are to a certain extent cushioned, or at least economists say this, because they saved more during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And that one of the things we're seeing now is that that savings flowing out onto goods and the goods piling up in the ships off the coast. Laura mentions the delay in emptying them. It used to be 3 to 4 days. Now the turnaround is 13 days, and it's probably going to get worse before it gets better. So, yeah, there are real problems there. You know, there's a tragic pattern to inflation, and that is that it's bad in itself, but that it one of the cures of it is even worse, which is unemployment. Mm. And we all lived through this in the 1970s, where Paul Volcker came in and basically jacked up to kill the beast inflation, jacked up interest rates so high, constricted the money supply so much that the economy went into a recession. We had the worst recession in 1981-82 since the Great Depression. And so that's if inflation gets out of hand, it goes to this even worse thing, an induced recession with mass unemployment. Mm.
So Jack and Laura, hang in here for just a second, because about the 1970s, we received a question from a Nonpoint listener about that. This is Ron from Springfield, Oregon, and he lived through that inflationary period in the 70s. And here's what he wants to know.
I am older, and I lived through the 1973 oil embargo and the inflation, and it was dramatic. I remember the gas prices going up. I remember the coffee prices tripling. It was horrific. So my question is this. What are the parallels between this inflationary period and those of, like, 1973?
Okay, so that's Ron, an On-Point listener from Springfield, Oregon, and gives me a chance to welcome into the conversation Diane Swonk, chief economist at the consulting firm Grant Thornton. She's also an advisor to the Federal Reserve Board and its regional banks. Diane Swonk, welcome back to you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Okay, so what do you think about Ron's question? Are there parallels between this inflationary period and the nightmare that some folks remember from the 70s?
Well, I remember those nightmares as well, as I sure Laura does as well. And I want to echo something that Laura said, and that is humility. Economists have gotten a heavy dose of humility during this pandemic and trying to forecast it, but in general about inflation over the last several decades. And I think that's absolutely right. I think it's important to point out what is different from the 1970s. One of the things we know about the 1970s was inflation took years upon years of policy mistakes to compound. People forget that the Vietnam War had already delivered us inflation by the latter part of the 1960s. There are a lot of policy mistakes, particularly by the Nixon administration, that compounded inflation before we got to wage and price controls. And we also had the depeg the dollar. We had a sharp depreciation in the dollar. And then we had the OPEC situation in 1973, which is where we first heard the word stagflation coined. And what was so critical about that period was that, you know, we had OPEC pull back on production on the supply side, as Laura has been talking about. There's disruptions on the supply side as well. But we already had some inflation baked in, most notably in wages. We had a very high rate of unionization, but more than unionization, white collar workers and blue collar workers alike got an automatic cost of living increase. They called it a COLA. And much like is baked into Social Security going up at the rate of inflation each year, the cost of living increase, people got that regardless of whether whether they were white or blue collar workers. About 80% of wages, by our analysis, were tied to a COLA in the 1970s, which meant they already got baked into the cake. All the increases that we saw in oil prices got baked into wages. And then we saw firms have to cut workers because they couldn't cut wages, which that really caused a vicious stagflation period that we saw there. And so it's very different in those ways in terms of how over the length of period of time of how many policy mistakes were compounded and how different the structure of our economy was. And, you know, really highlighting something that Laura pointed out as well is that, you know, the lowest wage workers are still low paid. And we look over 2 years to get through some of these bumps that we saw, the, you know, negative oil prices for a fleeting moment in April of 2020. Who would have thought? But those base effects look over the course of 2019 to 2021. And what you see is, particularly when it comes to energy prices, which are outside of the purview of the Federal Reserve to control, but yeah. I do think there are some things to worry about within the purview of the Federal Reserve. But, you know, the idea that what we've seen is purchasing power and the ability to even look for jobs, even though we've seen the fastest growth in wages at the lowest end of the wage spectrum in leisure and hospitality, those gains have been overwhelmed over a 2-year period by things like energy prices soaring. Mm-hmm. And that's really important because it means the commute costs, their ability of mobility is one of the things holding workers back and their ability to go and get jobs. They may be in urban centers or further out in rural areas, and the cost of commuting just to look for the jobs, it eats up all of those wage gains. We saw this in the wake of the Great Recession as well in the 2010s, where workers, I had clients who had workers who had to turn down promotions because they couldn't sell their house because they were underwater. And the promotion to a manager of a pizza place, even though it was a big bump in pay, the cost of commuting and an inability to move meant that they actually couldn't accept that promotion. Yeah. So these are important things to think about.
Okay. So look, for the three of you, I'm just going to lay bare my total ignorance here and say that part of me wants to just ask a question about, like, why does inflation even exist, period. But I, obviously it exists because of choices that are made by policymakers, by businesses, even by workers in individual households. So it's a complex answer. So let me figure, here's another simple question I have. And Diane, this it's inspired by what you just said, because how the Fed usually aims for a target rate of inflation, right? It's deciding what's good inflation versus bad inflation. But it's relative to something. So how do they know? What is the difference between good and bad inflation?
Well, it's pretty easy, actually, and it's one of those things that you only know in reality, and that's is when inflation starts to distort behaviors, it's bad. And when inflation doesn't distort behaviors and we don't notice it, it's good. And so they come up with these targets, but the bottom line is if you notice it, then something's gone wrong. And the question is, do you do something about it or not? And although I agree that this inflation will abate by 2023, I think it's going to abate slower than many would like. And my concern is the Federal Reserve will be forced into a position where it has to hedge against the risk that, because of our humility, that inflation could become more entrenched versus the risk of bringing people back into the labor force, which they'd like to desperately do. I mean, this is a Fed that has rethought all of its policy and said, you know, we'd rather run the economy a little hot and make sure we bring in people and level the playing field, much like we're doing at the latter stages of the last economic expansion, where employers had to abandon some biases and actually cast their net a little wider. And we weren't getting inflation then that was burning us. The problem is...
Diane Swong? We'll get you right back, Diane, here. But since you did mention the balancing act that the Federal Reserve is trying to pull off right now, here's Fed Chair Jerome Powell a couple of weeks ago testifying before Congress.
Right now, we're far away from, we think, full employment. So that gives us an incentive to keep accommodative policy strong, or to keep accommodative policy in place. Inflation is well above target, and we have an expectation that high inflation will abate because we think the factors that are causing it are temporary and tied to the pandemic and the reopening of the economy. And what we say is we just have to balance the two. But I would say our expectation is that inflation will come down and we won't ultimately face that difficult trade-off of having the two goals in tension.
So, Laura Tyson, we've just got about 30 seconds before our next break here. Do you have confidence in what Jerome Powell is saying there about his expectations?
Yes, I am in his camp, meaning this camp of people who believe that there are temporary factors that are related to the pandemic, that as we gradually bring supply chains back into ease, we will end up with the inflation rate coming down. I think it is important. Also, he mentioned expectations. There are lots of measures out there of what the market expects the inflation rate to be. The 1- and 2- and 3-year expectations are rates that are significantly higher than used to. Those rates used to be 2%. Now they're 3%, something like that, 3, sometimes 3.5%. But 5 to 10 years out, the market is saying, no, these rates are going to come back down. There isn't anything in the system that suggests this is a permanent change. This is temporary. It may last a little longer than we expected. It may be a little higher rate than expected. Jerome Powell also said that. But we're not worried about losing control. We're not worried about the long-run trajectory.
Well, we'll be back with some other views about that. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about inflation and trying to understand what's driving the current higher-than-usual inflation. What's the difference between good inflation and bad inflation? And the economic and political impact that having to spend more at the gas pump and at the grocery store could have on this country over the next several years. And, you know, not everyone is concerned about current higher prices. We got a comment here from Mike Parwana who says, I'm a blacksmith. 2.5 years ago, Trump instituted tariffs that increased prices on nearly all my raw materials, 10 to 25%. Then we had the pandemic. And Mike says, now low-income people are getting paid higher wages. If that leads to a few percent increase in goods and services, then I'm all for inflation. But, of course, the question is that what is leading to the current inflation that we're seeing. I'm joined today by Laura Tyson, Jack Beatty, and Diane Swank. And if the three of you could listen along with me, we want to actually just take a little step back in history, because this concept of inflation and its impact has been with actually humanity for, what, millennia here. But Rebecca Spang, professor of history at the University of Indiana, Bloomington, asks, when did we switch from saying things are getting too expensive to calling it this other thing, to calling it inflation?
So how do we know what inflation is? How do they measure it? How does anybody know how much inflation there is? This all goes back to actually the era of World War I.
It's 1919. And in South Chicago, steelworkers walk out of mills and stay out. In Gary, Indiana, struck mills are idle behind picket lines composed of women.
Dock workers and other people went on strike saying we cannot afford to live based on our wages because prices are rising.
At Indiana Harbor, streets are lined with idle workers and patrolling pickets.
Their employers said, prices aren't rising. You can do just fine. The idea was for the government to come in and measure the level of inflation to adjudicate between the claims of the workers that they could not live on their wages and the claims of the employers that, yeah, we're paying you plenty. So ever since then, the consumer price index has been measured on a monthly basis.
Millions, whatever figure was printed on the notes, really meant nothing. The German mark was worthless. As in a fearful dream, people's life savings were blown away like leaves in a gale.
Probably the most famous episode of inflation is the dramatic increase in prices that occurs in Weimar Germany, the German Republic. Germany, after defeat in World War I, basically was between a rock and a hard place in terms of paying off indemnities, dealing with social welfare demands from workers' movements, and with a pretty intransigent group of employers. So they calculated that it would be possible to survive through a period of rapid inflation, which got carried away. So you've probably seen the photos of people pushing wheelbarrows of money to buy groceries. People are using it as fire starters. They're using it to wallpaper their rooms. That kind of hyperinflation, the fear that there will be five more zeros stuck onto the price of everything, is the nightmare scenario of inflation that the public imagery circulates around. In the 1970s, the OPEC oil shock led to a sudden dramatic increase in the price of crude oil, which immediately translated to the price of gasoline at the pump.
What does a person like myself do?
To turn you down the lamp? Why didn't they come out and tell us there was no gas? Three or four cars? No, they did not.
You, the man down the line.
No man ever
8 o'clock.
Told.
We were supposed to pump at 8 o'clock. It's a quarter
the
to nine. What are you doing in line?
There were gasoline shortages. Schools started later so that they'd use less electricity. Everything seemed to be transformed by this in 1973, 1974.
6:30, and you expect to get gas at 6:30 in line? Forget it, lady.
In the aftermath of the Vietnam War and Watergate, the pressing issue as American politicians claimed a return to normalcy was the situation for ordinary Americans. Could ordinary Americans get ahead in the United States? Inflation became the issue of the day for politicians from Ford.
Inflation, our public enemy number one, will, unless whipped, destroy our country.
To Carter.
The phrase, sound as a dollar, was an expression of absolute dependability until 10 years of inflation began to shrink our dollar and our savings.
To Reagan.
This election will determine whether the nation and the world will ever again hear that great sound. Will determine if the dinner table of your home and the supermarkets of your neighborhood will ever again be places where plans can be made and necessities can be purchased without the gnawing doubt and, yes, fear brought by Mr. Carter's inflation and unemployment.
I think the rhetoric of inflation is being used very savvily to political ends. The bogeyman of inflation, the idea that inflation is always and everywhere bad and somehow always and everywhere the president's fault, this may perhaps be the legacy of the 1970s.
We have inflation that's killing the consumer. Gasoline prices in Gorda, California yesterday, $7.59. Food and energy is up over 10%. We're in trouble.
What is happening right now is that the rhetoric of inflation is being used very strategically for very specific political ends in an attempt to bring down the Biden presidency. And inflation has been such a bogey in American political discourse for the past 50 years, that there is a possibility that this might actually prove effective.
That's Rebecca Spang, professor of history at the University of Indiana Bloomington, author of many books, including Stuff and Money. So, Jack, let me turn to you. What do you think about the political implications of higher than usual inflation right now?
Well, they're inimical for Joe Biden. 56% in the morning consult blame his policies for inflation. 70% in another poll say we're going in the wrong direction. And even more ominously, given that he's just passed, or he hopes to pass, these two big stimulus, these two big infrastructure bills, 70% agree with this statement. People will pay more money on everyday expenses unless the government becomes more fiscally responsible. Biden rightly points out about his infrastructure bills, both of them, that they're counterinflationary in that they increase things like education and, you know, infrastructure, roads and so on. They make for greater productivity. In vain against the, you know, the politics of it. I mean, polls are already ads really are already being run against Democrats saying you're responsible for these prices. It's all on you. And forgotten, of course, is the profligate tax and spending policies of the Trump administration, which were hardly fiscally responsible. But once that rhetoric of fiscal responsibility returns, the Republican Party finds its sort of, you know, its latent virtue to talk about, oh, we've got to cut the budget, we've got to, and there's going to be more and more of that. And you know, those of us in the media have got to be really careful when we use Republican talking points. And this one is, inflation is real, but the Republicans are using it, claiming Biden caused it. Well, how did he cause it? They claim, well, the stimulus last March caused it. Well, according to studies, 70% of that money we got, you know, the $2,000 a family, that went into savings or retired debt. It wasn't inflationary. And then others point out, wait a minute, it can take 2 years for the inflationary effect of big government spending to show up. So it's hard to trace Biden's fingerprints to this. On the other hand, he's got to deal with these supply bottlenecks right. And quickly in order to get goods flowing.
Right, exactly. So, Diane Swonk, I think we have you back. So let me turn back to you. This is, I share Jack's frustration profoundly because, you know, how we talk about that intersection between the economy and politics and the media, it's often as if the economy follows the same 4-year discrete units that a presidential administration does, which is absolutely not true, right?
No, it's not. But, and I mean, it's one of the most frustrating things as an economist trying to delineate and keep people focused on what's really going on. And there are bad policies. We know we can trace bad policies, but you know the idea these things are always political and being traced to political. We just had an extraordinary event. We went through the looking glass, like Alice going through the looking glass when we went into the pandemic. Things worked in reverse, clocks turning backwards. You know, we had inflation as factories were still idled. We had labor shortages as millions were still unemployed. And we had interest rates plummet, even though debts and deficits exploded. I mean, you could have knocked me over with a feather to see 52 basis points, less than half, almost a half percent, on a 10-year Treasury bond in the summer of 2020 as the deficit was, you know, expanding. And that was because the world said, you know, given the trade-off, we'd rather take a negative inflation-adjusted return on financing your debt, United States, and have you stimulate, then face the alternative of what the world would look like if we didn't.
Yeah. So this leads me to the question of, okay, you know, in any administration, what came several years before them, not necessarily their fault, or, you know, they can't claim the credit for it either. But on the other hand, in the present, it is the person sitting behind that resolute desk. The buck stops there. So even though we've had all of these through the looking glass moments, Diane, as you're describing, that no one could have really foreseen, we're living it now. Understanding how inflation works, what are the things that the Biden administration ought to get done ASAP? What can they do?
You know, I mean, understanding how inflation works is the big assumption, right? I mean, as Laura pointed out, there's a lot of humility here. And in this world, the old rules of thumb clearly don't apply, and that is difficult. I think one of the things that we need to think about is we can't give up on infrastructure, climate change, and the existential threat that means, because that's going to make the world more inflationary, the disruptions. People forget Hurricane Ida idled refining production and made gas prices higher. I mean, these extreme weather events are becoming more repetitive. That is a result of climate change, and these are things that we have to address. There are huge benefits. There's a window of opportunity of ultra-low rates right now, and I think the government should finance infrastructure investment and take advantage of the ultra-low rates we have and do even longer-term bonds than what we have to finance it. On the flip side of it, you know, the kitchen sink of things that are in the budget proposal from the administration, some of them do enhance productivity growth. Some of them are going to make it easier for people to work, but there are things that are inflationary in it as well and should be paid for via either tax hikes or spending cuts, and we need to decide those priorities as a country. And if we don't do that, we could be adding, you know, dry tinder to an already hot current inflation situation. It may dissipate over time, but that's not in that time. People get burned. And I think these are the things we need to have some really thoughtful debate about. Unfortunately, in the world of politics, we get, you know, soundbite solutions and people actually playing around with things that, you know, could cause a big deflationary episode, like, you know, not lifting the debt limit and an economic argument getting on top of a pandemic. I mean, that just is mind-boggling to me, that where the political rhetoric is relative to where we need to be in terms of thinking about these issues.
Okay, so Laura Tyson, I'm going to come to you in just a second, but Diane, I didn't have a chance to ask you about whether you think Laura said she believes this is a transitory moment. I mean, do you too? Because I think that sometimes we go through periods of history where everything gets turned upside down, and when things get right side up again, it's not the same though.
So I agree with Laura that this is not going to be this kind of inflation for a long period of time. I do think it's going to persist through 2022 and into early 2023, and that's going to put the Federal Reserve in an extremely difficult position. The flow through of shelter costs and what that means for inflation, about 0.5% to base level of inflation next year, is going to be a problem. And it's going to be really hard for the Fed, in the humility of all of us as economists, to determine, do they raise rates to damp down inflation that could burn those who can afford it least, but also that has consequences for those who could afford it least, or do they risk inflation becoming more entrenched? I do think by 2023, 2024, we'll see inflation abate, but that's a long time for transitory. And even though technically as an economist I can say that's nothing like the 1970s, and you know, we should look through some of that, I also understand, you know, from the Federal Reserve's perspective, that at some point in time they're going to have to hedge against it becoming more entrenched, because the world is different than it was.
Well, Laura Tyson, we've got about a minute left here, and I want to circle around to back to the point that Jack was making, because it's really important. Again, what we have though is the politics of the moment too. So I just wanted to get your quick take on that. What impact inflation could have on American politics right now?
It is American politics that the person sitting in the White House, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, is blamed for the macroeconomic events of his period or her period someday in time. So I'm not surprised. And that the Biden administration is being blamed for inflation. It's wrong. It has no reality to it, but that is the politics, and it's historically the politics, as was mentioned by our historian. So let me say then that I think the action here is going to be is going to be on the Federal Reserve side. It's not going to be on the fiscal side. The fiscal side, that the Biden Build Back Better infrastructure agenda is a supply-enhancing agenda. It will actually combat lower inflation over time. It is not a source of inflation right now. The deficit of the U.S. Government is not a source of inflation right now. There's no evidence that it's related. The size of the deficit relative to GDP and inflation have anything to do with one another. So I think I would say look to monetary authorities, look to the central bank, and remember, and I wish people would remember.
Just got a couple seconds
thinking here.
Yeah.
Okay, the transitory issue is a transitory.
I'm so sorry. I just have 10 seconds left here, so we'll have to stop it there. But Laura Tyson, Jack Beattie, and Diane Swong, thank you all so much for joining us today. This is On Point.